Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, on our Talk Back segments, we'll be offering you the latest on health and healing, including how what many of you have been consuming, a plant-based diet, can help a broad spectrum of illnesses you may have. Also, for lupus patients, I'll give you the latest insights on that and why you don't want to be eating genetically modified wheat. I'll tell you why in a few moments. So we have a lot to share on health and healing, including the latest on pomegranate. Also today, I'm adding in several other issues, including a few commentaries, and I'll ask you to call in about it. I'm very concerned about a nation that accepts mental illness diagnosis so easy, allows themselves to be on psychoactive drugs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, ends up having epidemics of suicide and violent rage. 95% of all mass killers in the United States have been on psychoactive drugs. Why aren't we questioning this? From the environmental segment, the so-called new golden age of oil that you've been hearing about, well, it's not so golden. Michael T. Clare will give us the latest from Tom's Dispatch on the lies about golden age of oil. And Professor James Tracy from Persuasion to Coercion, Psychopharmacist Priesthood of the Mind. Time permitting, I'll also take a look at how kids are getting hooked on pills for life. Evelyn Pringle and Martha Rosenberg. We have a lot to share. And of course, about 20 minutes into our program, I'll be taking your calls. No guest. We never have a guest on our talkback, so there's more opportunity for you to call in. According to the World Health Organization, as reported in Science Daily and published in Food Technology, all major orthodox centers, the more plant you have in your diet, the more fruits and vegetables, the healthier you're going to be. In fact, they're saying that about 63% of the deaths that occurred in 1 year were attributed to non-communicable chronic illnesses like heart disease and cancers and diabetes and obesity. Why? Poor diets. Those are the contributing factors. Now, when you consider that probably everyone listening right now has a knowledge of how to eat a healthy diet, and most of you are probably on a plant-based diet, then you're going to be substantially protected from having these illnesses at the same time if you exercise. That's what this is saying. So you think that maybe a lot more people would be interested in this? In point of fact, the answer is no. To the contrary, where there's a growing number of individuals who are making changes in their diet, the vast majority of Americans, about 90%, are living extraordinarily unhealthy lives. That also goes for young people and teenagers as well. Increased flavonoid intake reduces the risk of aggressive prostate cancer. What are flavonoids? Well, these are compounds found in plants, like onions, which are very rich in quercetin, and you'll have some flavonoids in grapefruit, lemon, lime, and orange, especially in the white peel right underneath. But you also have them in other foods as well. Here's what they're saying. The higher the intake of flavonoids, the lower your risk of aggressive prostate cancer. Quote, incorporating more plant-based foods and beverages like fruits and vegetables and herbs and teas into the diet can help offer some protection against aggressive prostate cancer. That's according to Dr. Susan Steck, associate professor at the Arnold School of Public Health, University of South Carolina. Quote, filling your plate with flavonoid-rich foods is one behavior that can be changed to have a beneficial impact on health. I'm suggesting for this audience 11 servings minimum of fruits and vegetables a day. And one way that you can absolutely guarantee you get that is having 2 16-ounce glasses of fresh vegetable or 1 vegetable and 1 fruit juice a day. For the patients in this audience who have lupus, from a new clinical study published in Arthritis Research and Therapy, vitamin D is important as an immunomodulator agent for systemic lupus erythematosus. By the way, that's a very debilitating autoimmune disease. You start to get it in the skin, the joints, and then it becomes neurological, and then it ends up in your kidneys, and you can die from it. It's an inflammation of the tissue linings. So by having more vitamin D, either getting outside with more sun exposure or taking supplements, that can be a substantial benefit to you. Just a heads up, there's a lot of danger in using genetically modified foods. They've never been proven safe, and now they've been shown not to be the great savior of the world, because organic, sustainable agriculture actually gives us higher nutrient yields per acre. What the genetically modified corn and maize and wheat and soy gives us is a lot of super weeds, destruction of our soil, a lot more pesticides. Now the Australian government, in the form of its science research arm, is joining big agribusiness, profiting by designing a GM wheat that could kill people who eat it, and by inheriting the gene that will impact their children. Now here's how this works, from Heidi Stevenson. She says that the worst damage from genetic engineering we haven't seen, but we will, if Australia's governmental agency, the Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization, is allowed to go ahead and develop a wheat species that is engineered to turn off genes permanently. According to Professor Jack Heinemann of the University of Canterbury's Center for Integrated Research and Biosafety, he studied the wheat's potential. He published an article in the peer-reviewed digital journal, and he said that, quote, we have found it is the molecules created in this wheat intended to silence wheat genes can match human genes, and through digestion of that wheat, these molecules can enter the human beings and potentially silence our genes. The findings are absolutely assured. There is no doubt that these matches exist. Echoing that is, and clarifying, is Professor Judy Carman of Flinders University. Quote, if this silences the same gene in us that it silences in the wheat, well, children who are born with this enzyme not working tend to die by the age of about 5. Silencing the equivalent gene in humans is to silence the genetically modified wheat holds the potential of killing people. But it gets worse. Silenced genes are permanently silenced and can be passed down through the generations. So, behind the public venue, the GMO people are working to create products we do not need, that are inherently dangerous, and they're spending $1 million a day or more in California to defeat a major proposition, Proposition 37. Now, there's only 2 weeks to go before that is voted on. Many of us are working every single day, all day, in trying to inform the public in California what's wrong with genetically engineered food, why we should have it labeled. And once it's labeled, 90% of the American population said they would not buy it. Once we win in California, if we do, then every single state could pick this same legislation up and we could literally put up Monsanto out of business and others. But we don't have the money. We just have those of us, Jeffrey Smith and others, and grassroots people who are passing information along. So I'm asking all the people in this audience listening from California, please spread the information. And we have a lot of it on our website. Have all these major articles and videos to show you the truth about why genetically engineered foods are bad for you. We'd like for you to help get out the vote to vote yes on Proposition 37, we want our food labeled. if it's genetically engineered. Also, new research on pomegranate. And this is good research. And pomegranate can help reverse clogged arteries. And that's very important because when you look at how many people in the United States die of some form of heart disease, then it's the number one disease killer in the United States. Well, here we have the pomegranate, and you could take it as a pomegranate juice, unsweetened, pomegranates themselves, or the pomegranate powder. They're all good. And pomegranate gives your mouth and your gums quite a workout. It's an astringent, and it helps disinfect your mucous membranes. That's good because a lot of people carry harmful bacteria in their mouth all the time. When you drink the juice, it's very effective in helping to stimulate the cleansing, natural chelation, and the healing of your epithelial tissue. That's the lining of your arteries. That's very positive. So this research shows that pomegranate is very important. It's published in the peer-reviewed journal Clinical Nutrition. And they took a group of patients who had atherosclerosis, and they measured how clogged the carotid artery is that goes up to the brain. And then they gave pomegranate juice, and after 1 year, the plaque clogging their carotid arteries was reduced by up to 30%. So that's in a very statistically significant way of reversing atherosclerosis. So that's good news, but we also know that pomegranate will lower your blood pressure. If you have hypertension, one of the things that pomegranate does, it has the ability to inhibit angiotensin-converting enzyme and in research. And also reversing the plaque buildup in the arteries is one way to disburden the heart as well. And another is that pomegranate has the ability to increase nitric oxide production in the arteries, which result in improvement to its ability to dilate, effectively reversing endothelial dysfunction. And it helps prevent the avian influenza, candida, E. coli. It can help if you have hepatitis, if you have poxviruses, salmonella, SARS, Staphylococcus aureus. Has all these wonderful qualities that will fight infection in the body. Now, if you take it with other known fighters of infection, like vitamin C at high doses, then you got a really good combination working on your behalf. And finally today, one last study here, and then we're going to go to some of our other topics. There's a lot being said about fermentation, and the latest is that we all need and should have ideally about 2 to 4 billion, that's with a B, billion good probiotics per day into our diet. Why? Because every time you eat sugar or you drink alcohol in any amount, when you have processed carbohydrates, muffins, rolls, bagels, pasta, those are all broken down into simple sugars and or polysaccharides or disaccharides or monosaccharides. And that means you're more susceptible to yeast overgrowth, candida overgrowth. And that means that you're going to have more bad bacteria. And that can lead to itises and inflammation and infections, colitis, diverticulitis, Crohn's disease. By having good bacteria, you recolonize the gut, and that in turn allows for healthy epigenetics. So just make sure that you're getting your good probiotics every day. Now let's go directly to some other issues, because I'm a very big believer that we have to look at our environment. I'm sure many of you saw in the debates both President Obama and his challenger, Mitt Romney, were talking about drilling and that we could become energy independent. We wouldn't need oil from the Middle East. And that's what we want. Put people back to work, drill for gas, drill for oil. They also praise coal, clean coal, and they praise nuclear. Well, in point of fact, those are all very toxic. They're what have caused all of our problems. And if you look at Germany and you look at China, countries that are really advocating solar, you'll see that the technology is there that we could be going solar right now, along with geothermal, which we already have these hot mineral springs all over the United States. We're just not using any of them. Plus, we have wave, the most consistently powerful free source of energy that's completely non-polluting is wave energy. Everywhere you have water in the ocean, you have waves. And those waves turn turbines, which create energy. We're not looking at that either. So when they talked about how we really got to do the right thing, like draw every way you can, and both President Romney were both racing towards a cliff talking about how they would open up all of our coastal areas and internal areas and government land. In point of fact, last year, fossil fuel enthusiasts began trumpeting the dawn of what they're calling the Golden Age of Oil, according to Michael T. Clare from Tom Dispatch. And in turn, we're told that would kickstart the American economy, you know, generate millions of new jobs, and free our country from its dependence on imported oil. In fact, once this surge in U.S. energy production was linked to a predicted boom in energy from Canada's tar sand reserves, but no one ever actually explained. Did you hear anyone tell you what tar sands are? And that it's not the same as the sweet crude oil that comes up out of the ground now. And we were told that we have a lot of good oil in North America. And they said, quote, it's becoming the new Middle East, end quote. Everybody jumped on the bandwagon. And we said, we have the technology and the money to create the new technologies to allow us to become energy independent, mainly by deep water drilling and hydraulic fracturing or hydrofracking. And the energy companies all said that we were on the verge of unlocking vast new stores of oil in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico and the shale formations in the United States. This was supposed to be the great revival. Well, they gave you a half-truth. Let me share, along with Michael T. Clare, the other side of what they did not tell you or didn't show you. For example, on any single trip out there, including to Oklahoma earlier this year, did they actually show you photographs of what the earth looks like when the tar sands from Alberta are being excavated, where gigantic 20-mile across strip mining, giant holes in the earth? No. Did they show you what happens to a person's home or farm or the streams or aquifers or rivers near a hydrofracking? They show you how much water is used, especially when you have over 70% of the United States right now is in a severe and what will probably be a prolonged drought, where water, just for human use, is essential, and hydrofracking uses almost more water than anything except a nuclear power plant, and that uses the most of anything on Earth, 2 billion gallons a day per the plant. For example, we have 2 nuclear power plants at Indian Point, 28 miles north of Manhattan. Well, that's 4 billion gallons a day of water out of the Hudson. So it turns out the future may prove far more recalcitrant than these prophets of an American energy cornucopia imagine. To reach their ambiguous targets, energy firms will have to overcome severe geological and environmental barriers. And recent developments suggest they are doing little to do that. Consider this. This is just one example. They have not told you what shale oil or oil shale or Arctic oil or deep offshore oil and tar sands, which is bitumen, actually are. And as for conventional petroleum, we're far past that. The unconventional oil, that's what they're looking at, that is to liberate the U.S. and its neighbors from the unreliable producers of Middle Eastern oil, involves substances too hard or viscous to be extracted using standard technological or other types of systems we have. In other words, it's called tough oil. Now, shale oil is the oil trapped in shale rock, and it can only be liberated through the application of concentrated force in a process known as hydraulic fracturing that requires millions of gallons of chemically laced water per frac, plus the subsequent disposal of the vast quantities of toxic wastewater once the fracking has been completed. Oil shale, or what is called kerogen, is a primitive form of petroleum that must be melted to be useful, in a process that itself consumes vast amounts of energy. And the tar sands that everyone's giving a big wet kiss to, or oil sands, as the industry prefers to call them, must be gouged from the earth using open pit mining technology, or pumped up after first being melted in the place by underground steam jets, then treated with toxic, poisonous, cancer-causing chemicals. Now, once then, and only then, can the material be transported to refineries, for example, the highly controversial Keystone Pipeline. And similarly, deep water and Arctic drilling requires the deployment of specialized multi-million-dollar rigs, along with enormously costly backup safety systems under the most dangerous of conditions. All these processes have at least one thing in common. Each pushes the envelope of what is technologically possible in extracting oil or natural gas from geologically and geographically forbidden environments. They are all, that is, versions of extreme energy. And I believe that's what we should call them, extreme energy. To produce them, energy companies will have to drill in extreme temperatures or extreme weather, or extreme pressures, or operate under extreme danger at extreme depths, or some combination of all these. In each, it is not will accidents happen absolutely, positively, unequivocally. We're going to have accidents. And then there are going to be setbacks, guaranteed. And they're going to become very frequent. And then what will we be told when an oil well blows in the Arctic and there's no way in the world to stop it, or at a very deep level? I believe that we are looking at the most foolish and irresponsible energy policies in American history, as if we learn nothing from Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. And just this year, I was contacted in my travels, because I was traveling through Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, Alabama, Florida, Texas, and there are large numbers of people who now suffer from environmental illness who worked at cleaning up the tar sands, and no one ever compensated them. They have all forms of immune illnesses. They're not being recognized. In one meeting alone, there was 141 people from one small town. And yet it's no longer in a news cycle. We thought the problem is solved. It isn't. And all this toxic crustaceans, the shrimp, and fish, they're all contaminated to some level. And yet you see the ads on television. Come back to the Gulf. People are fishing and swimming and great food. No, it's not great food. It's poison. And we're not willing to be honest about it. And perhaps the most notable example of this is Shell Oil's costly failure to commence test drilling in the Alaskan Arctic. They invested $4.5 billion and years of preparation, and Shell was poised to drill 5 test wells this summer in Beaufort and other seas off Alaska's northern northwestern coast. However, just recently, on September 17th, a series of accidents and mishaps forced the company to announce that it would suspend operations until next summer, the only time when those waters are largely free of pack ice and safe to drill. Shell's problems began early and picked up pace as the summer wore on, and its Noble Discovery, a drill ship, was forced to abandon operations at the Berger Prospect, about 70 miles offshore in the Chukchi Sea, when floating ice threatened the safety of the ship. We're talking about large icebergs. And a more serious setback occurred later in the month when a containment dome, that's what they use to cover any leak that develops at an underground well, malfunctioning during test. And it did malfunction in Puget Sound in Washington State. So here's the idea. If in very calm water in the summer they can't test something, what exactly are they supposed to do in the most treacherous Arctic waters when they now have no power over ice flow and gusty wind? Some of the worst environments in the world in the ocean is up in the Bering Straits. And you're going to drill there? So we have to be aware we're now dealing with not just extreme energy exploration, but even you have to bring in extreme water. Now, what do I mean by that? This is another unexpected impediment to the arrival of energy's next golden age in North America. And here's what it means. It means that right now, as I'm speaking with you, 80% of the U.S. agricultural land is in the grip of drought. See, we forget when the summer's over and we're in the fall or winter. The drought doesn't stop. The rains don't come. And so what was dry gets dry and now can freeze. And any increase in U.S. hydrocarbon output will require greater extraction of oil and gas from the shale rock, which can only be accomplished via hydrofracking. And more fracking in turn means more water consumption. And with the planet warming, thanks to climate change, such intensive droughts are expected to intensify in many regions, which means rising agriculture demand with far less water, including potentially in prime fracking locations like Bakken Formation, North Dakota, the Eagle Ford of West Texas, and the Marcellus Formation in Pennsylvania and New York State. So the drought's impact on hydrofracking became strikingly evident when in June and July, wells and streams started drying up in many drought-stricken areas, and drillers suddenly found themselves competing with hard-pressed food producers for whatever water was available. And we just didn't have enough for everyone. Then you have to look at the lulls at the state level that they're allowing the hydrofracking to have the water first. So this is just one more reason why this is a problem. In the United States, we also have the opposition to tar sands, and mainly that's focused on the construction of the Keystone Pipeline, a $7 billion, 2,000-mile conduit that would carry diluted tar sands oil from Hardisty, Alberta, to refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast, and that's thousands of miles away. And part of the Keystone system are already in place, and if completed, the pipeline is designed to carry 1 million barrels a day of unrefined liquid across the United States. Well, those of us who are opposed to this charge that the project will contribute to the acceleration of climate change. It also exposes crucial underground water supplies in the Midwest to severe risk of contamination by the highly corrosive tar sands fluid. Remember, pipelines carrying fuel leak all the time. And citing the closeness of its proposed route to the critical Ocala aquifer, the largest in America, President Obama denied permission for its construction last January because it will cross an international boundary. The president gets to make the call. He is, however, expected to grant post-election approval to a new, less aquifer-threatening route. And Romney could care less. He says, build wherever you want to build. So even if the Keystone were in place, the golden age of Canada's tar sands won't be in sight. Not without yet more pipelines, as the bitumen producers face mounting opposition to their extreme operations. And we can thank Bill McKibben for informing us of this at the very beginning. So in conclusion, what we're dealing with is we're dealing with the American, the Canadian, and the world population believing that the future will be able to be sustainable only if we drill for oil and gas and continue with nuclear and the new clean coal technology. It's just all lies. And you'll see this as it plays out. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment with your calls. It's time for you to call in on our talkback segment. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Hey, Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We're broadcasting all over the world, and our sister station, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFK in Los Angeles, WBAI in New York, all through the Progressive Radio Network, all over the world. Let's say hello to James from New Jersey. Hi, James, your turn.
Hi, Gary. Good evening. Mm-hmm. By the way, that's a very nice photo of you with the blue suit over on Facebook, before I begin.
Thank you.
Now, I have an exercise-related question, but I just want to say really quick, but I don't know if people are aware of this, but in terms of clean energy, the German scientists have, from what I understand, have developed a tower that will take the heat from the desert ground and convert it to electricity, plus there's also a hydroelectric buoy that kind of bobs in the ocean water that also produces electricity. So there are many things that the nightly news really doesn't present to people in terms of that. There's a lot of promise out there. Now, with exercise, I've been working out throughout my life through the decades, and when I used to lift heavy weights with low repetitions, I did get muscle mass, but I also got a lot of injuries. So I would bounce back and forth as a kid. Of course, the kids read the steroid head muscle magazines, and they try to mimic the workouts done by all the competitive bodybuilders, which is, of course, they don't mention that they're on the juice. And it just drives them nuts. They constantly change their workouts. But then I read some information coming from Europe, I think it was Germany, that sometimes it's just best to do one extremely high-volume set to failure, like as many as 100 reps, and just not worry about how much weight the other guy in the gym is lifting, and get away from the ego aspect.
Well, what is your question?
Oh, my question is, what system seems to consistently work well for you and the people that that you train?
All right. I do have a video that's free that you can see. Have you looked up there the exercise video I have on my website?
Okay.
All right. That will. I take you into the gym and I show you the different exercises. Here's what I found works, because I was a bodybuilder. I was a weightlifter at one time, one of the strongest in the state of West Virginia.
Okay.
And I found that that didn't work. What I find is ideal for me, and for it's also modified work for other people, is you combine first your aerobic exercise, which keeps your lean muscle tissue at an optimal level, so you don't really have much body fat at all, but it keeps your musculature strong. It keeps your bones strong, because every time you're running or power walking, you're forcing the important minerals like calcium, magnesium, and boron, and manganese, and silica, and phosphorus into the long bones. So you're getting strong bones to support a strong frame.
Right.
Then you separate out your exercise into three areas, your abs, your upper body, and your lower body. And for that, I suggest 4 days a week, up to an hour. And I believe in doing 20 reps with maximum weight to exhaustion. So let's say that I was hand curling, strict. No, I don't believe in jerking. I believe in strict curl. And do it slow, because your benefit when you do a curl or a push-up or a butterfly is in the resistance coming back, not just in your forward forcing the arm up.
So yeah,
when your arm when your arm comes back, if you did it extra slow, in other words, really go slow, like 15 to 20 seconds to let your arm come down, that creates a new energy and memory in the protoplasm, which is the actual tissue. Now, if you supplement with creatine monohydrate, if you give yourself some D-ribose, if you're taking coenzyme Q10 and L-carnitine, and the tocotrienols, what's happening is that all that works together along with the branched chain amino acids to actually expand the cell. So you get the dynamic of a very strong body, but deceptive because you don't have to bulk. So you can have a lot more strength than a person that's overbound with muscles.
So you're not putting stress on the tendons and ligaments either.
There's no injury this way, no injury at all. And yeah. I've probably worked with maybe 30,000 athletes that I've trained doing the New York City Marathon, and the strength training is a part of their conditioning. And every single one has finished the marathon and has remained strong because of it. Thanks for your call. All the best to you. David from Oregon. Hi, David.
Gary, two questions, Gary. One, with magnetic pads, does it matter which side of the pad, which polarity of the pad one uses, whether it's whatever, sitting, laying down, whatever the use is?
They'll tell you on every magnet whether it's unipolar or bipolar, and they generally give you a green insignia, and that's the side you use. The green you use, the red you don't. The red goes down, the green is what stays up that you actually lay on. Okay? All the best. Let's say hello to Flory from Miami. Hi, Flory.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for the show. My question tonight, I have a 10-year-old girl who decided to become a vegetarian, and she eats a lot of fish. I'm a little concerned with the mercury. She eats beans, quinoa, rice, all the grains, still doing organic eggs and cheese. She's not ready to let go of the dairy. I'm just a little concerned, coming from an animal protein, how to do this in a safe way so she can grow up properly and get enough protein. That's my concern.
Yeah. And so your question is?
What do you suggest so she's covered with the amount of protein she needs if she's not doing poultry?
First, the body does not require any protein. The body requires amino acids, which are the building blocks of protein. Now, you can get your building blocks or amino acids from brown rice, quinoa, spirulina, chlorella, black beans, soybeans. You can get them from all non-animal sources. And in fact, they're best from that source because they're not concentrated. So if you had, for example, a cup of soybeans in a salad, you're getting about 25 grams of complete high-quality protein, equal to and superior than that which you would get from a hot dog or a hamburger, and or even a piece of fish, for that matter, without any of the mercury, or and the fish wouldn't have to suffer, and fish do suffer.
Uh-huh.
So the idea that we need all this protein is a myth. This is a myth that's been perpetrated by the industries that give us protein, mainly the meat industry and the dairy industry. Now, when I was growing up, I was a vegetarian, but I did have non-fat dry milk because this was before the science of exercise was well known. And so we would take big protein shakes before or after a workout. Sometimes when I think back, how many scoops of non-fat dry milk did we have? It'd be about 250 grams protein. And that was way beyond any that we needed. In fact, you don't really need more protein when you're doing a workout. You need more available glucose, which is what your body's burning as energy. You're not burning amino acids as energy. That's just a waste of amino acids. So by having a good vegan diet where you're serving a healthy shake in the morning where you can put some coconut oil, flaxseed oil, a handful of almonds or walnuts or cashews or macadamia nuts. You're putting in some of your protein powder, some non-genetically engineered protein. For a 10-year-old, if you were to get 15 grams of high-quality protein in the morning, that's all the body requires. Now, we only require 9-tenths of a gram per kilogram of protein per day. So let's just say that for a woman, an average 130-pound woman, 5'5", that's about 35 to 40 grams a day. For a man, let's say you're 6 foot and you're 190 pounds, that'd be about 60 grams a day. Well, let me give an example. One piece of fish contains more than your entire daily requirement. So the question is, what happens when you take in more protein than the body can use? There's no mechanism to store protein, as there is for fat, for sugar. So what happens is it's broken down. It's called deaminization. And the two organs that are responsible for this breakdown are the liver and the kidneys. And that stresses both because you have byproducts, ammonium, and which is very toxic, that comes from this breakdown. And also it requires extra energy. So you are creating more toxic kidneys and liver. You have more protein. Even vegetarians have more protein than what they actually require. And this can create problems of urea and ammonium buildup. So go to a moderate protein diet. And if you follow any of the eating programs, as I've written about repeatedly and have in virtually all my books, then you'll be right in the right range. If you're pregnant, lactating, recovering from illness, such as a fever, if you're doing extensive workouts, you modify that intake. But otherwise, don't be concerned. Okay? All the best to you. And let's say hello now to, on our program, we'll say hello to, who do we have here? Al from Long Island. Hi, Al. It's your turn.
Gary?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Gary, a few months ago, you had Professor Peter Phillips as a guest on your program. He was very good. But he made a statement, which I found to be odd. He said that he was talking about the laws that are being passed which restrict our constitutional rights. And he was making an analogy to Hitler. He said that Hitler did everything by law. And then a few weeks later, you on another program, you said that, I think you said Hitler, Stalin, and Mao did everything according to law. Again, analogizing that to our erosion of constitutional rights, which are being done by congressional legislation and executive orders. However, there's another aspect to this, and that is laws are being broken. I think that's more important. Laws are being broken, crimes are being committed, and they're not being prosecuted. And, for example, when Stalin had 45,000 Polish officers executed in 1940 without trial, without
due
process.
Hold on, sir. Al?
Yeah.
You're talking about the Chechen Forest Massacre in Poland.
Right.
That understands something, that what Stalin did, because it was blamed at that point on the Nazis, it was actually Stalin. It was thousands of the soldiers, the officers. It was officers. What I found important about that was that there were so few people who were guarding them, and they all had a chance to see how the people ahead of them were being executed. And so they saw the people were running into a trench and just being shot in the back of the head. You would have thought, why don't they run? If they're going to get shot, they're going to get shot anyhow. And if there are more of them than there are the guards, why don't they make a break for it? I found what was important in that whole understanding, because I wrote an article on it, was how easy it is to break a person's will to fight. And my analogy, and I believe Professor Phillips is the same, was that Hitler and all tyrants, one of the first things they do when they get into power is they pass laws to allow them to control all dissidents. Who are the first persons always purged in every new government, or any time one regime is toppled, another takes its place? The intellects, the artists, the thinkers, the anarchist, the people most likely not to fall into alignment, not to just be obedient. And so when Hitler created laws, he could say that you were being prosecuted or put into an internment or a detention center or concentration camp because you had violated some law. In the United States, we now have made it a criminal process for you to protest near a government official if they have Secret Service protection, and you wouldn't know that they do. For example, if you found the president of Bahrain or the king of Saudi Arabia to be offensive and you wanted to go to the UN and protest their being there, they would have Secret Service protection. You could be arrested as a terrorist. There are watch lists in the United States. So they couldn't have done this until they passed the anti-terrorism acts, like the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act, the National Defense Authorization Act. So what I am saying very clearly is that the United States has become a police state. We now live in a form of not just creeping, but galloping fascism. And therefore, when anyone in power chooses to use the laws that are in place against those that they find to be objectionable, they can have the full power of the state to do so. There's an old English proverb, and it says, "There's none so blind as those who won't see." But then I think of something closer to home, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who I enjoy his writings, who said, "People only see what they are prepared to see." So while you will be questioning, and rightly so, the dictates of people in power and ask, why do we have so many laws? The reality is that we should completely review every single statute and law in America, millions of them. And we should have truly progressive jurists, people who are independent of ideologies, and see which of these should be dismantled. And I would bet that 90% of the laws we now have would be taken out and eliminated. But we won't do that. We'll continue to hire lawmakers that all they do is justify their position by adding more laws. And the quality of our life is not enhanced because the laws that they enact, nor are we protected. To the contrary, they are now so firmly in the pockets of the ALEC-related corporate sponsors that almost every law passed now in the United States has nothing to do whether or not it benefits you or I as individuals or the environment or the protection and sanctity of life, but rather how it can either help push an agenda of a corporate sponsored forward, or how it can deregulate something that would help the profitability of that corporation. Hence, the laws today are one of the most insidious forms of corruption. I appreciate your call. We'll take a call now from Bill from Long Island. Hi, Bill. Bill, you're on. No? All right, let's go over and say Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hi, Gary. I love getting emails from your audience. We have Linda from San Francisco who writes in, and she says, I saw you filming recently. A friend of mine was the driver of a person that you were filming, and out in California, San Francisco. She said, we sat there for 3 hours and watched the dialogue between you and the person you were filming. My friend and I agreed that the whole 3 hours were phenomenal. The question becomes, how much of that 3 hours will actually get into whatever film you're creating? And she's asking, is there some way that the audience can see the entire interview?
Historically, no, because I might film 100 to 500 hours, what ends up as a final hour and a half documentary. But now what I'm doing is we have our archivist, an editor in New York, as I film, I ask them, keep the best parts of the interview and we'll put them up on the internet. So beginning in about a month from now, hundreds, if not thousands of hours, by different topics, by some of the greatest people on the planet, will be posted for people to review. Okay?
Great.
Let's say hello to Spurro from North New Jersey. Hi.
Hey, hi, how are you?
Good.
Great. I wanted to make a brief comment about activism in general and then make a specific comment about Proposition 37 efforts.
Please do.
And okay, the brief comment is this, that activism is supposed to address dysfunctions of society, but when activism itself is dysfunctional, you have a much bigger problem. And I don't think that's addressed enough. For example, if you see this film by Oliver Stone called South of the Border, he's told by one of the heads of a country that he's interviewing that there's a new actor here, which is social movements, but he never asks him any details about it, at least that shows up in the film. Now, specifically about Proposition 37, what I'd like to see happen, and I really want you and your audience to consider this, although it's primarily up to you, is to create a, what I'd like to see happen is to have a flyer created, which you would post on your website, you would tell people about through your radio program, and then it could be downloaded and printed out on people's printers, and then they could take a short walk to their public school and hand them out to parents who are dropping off or picking up their children, and even to the children themselves. I grew up in a suburb, and there's not many concentrations of people that makes it easier to get to them.
Okay.
Basically, a school or a church.
Let me refer to that because we're running out of time. We only have a minute to go. We have more than 100 articles on the dangers and lack of science on genetic engineering on our website. We have over 50 different categories. Every day, even at night, we have people collecting progressive articles from authors on how we can solve problems without being ideological in the process. And so any one of those articles can be downloaded. On vaccines, we have the same. You could take any one of 22 articles that Richard Gale and I have written in the last year, and you could do the same with those. We have documentaries. We have sections of documentaries. Free. The one right now is The War on Health. You could download that. You could share that with everyone you can. So we are doing that. In fact, on Proposition 37, all over California, people for the first time are learning what is wrong with genetic engineering because of 15-minute clips that we've been sending them for a couple months every week. In fact, tomorrow I'll be sending them another one. And then we're asking, please share this with other people. Get it posted wherever you can. So I absolutely agree. We need to be as proactive as possible, but you have to work with people who are already open to wanting to change and are not afraid of the information and are not afraid of being uncomfortable enough to say, yes, we've made some mistakes, let's correct them. I appreciate your concern. Thank you. Well, I look at the clock and we're out of time, and I'm happy that you all took your time to share this hour, this talk back hour. I look forward to sharing more on our program tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.